All right. So, hi, everybody. Thank you. Thank you for coming. The Sunday sessions are, I don't have a mic, so we'll do our best to project. We have a terrific panel and a very diverse panel. So what I thought that we would do is this is a room full of journalists, full of writers, and so it makes sense for our session to be very craft oriented. Well, how do you really do this, assuming that you're crazy enough to want to do it? So we thought we would sort of go step by step through the book process. And as you'll see, especially now, there are many routes to a book, many routes. We're going to actually, we have a diverse enough panel that we'll be exploring some of the principal routes to get there, and you'll see how different they are. So I think what we'll do is just take questions throughout, instead of just having prepared talk and then time for questions. I think we'll go sort of step by step. And so, I'll begin by introducing and then say we'll start talking about idea generation. And so if you have questions about what we say about idea generation, just raise your hand and we'll do it throughout. And then we'll move on to the next step. So just, I guess my only request is, fire up those questions, but try to keep them relatively pertinent to whatever stage it is that we're talking about. There are books outside. Support your local authors. You will not see my book because it turns out I didn't actually write the book. There is no book.
I can disprove that.
Thank you,
Randy.
Thank you.
Order it.
Thank you, Randy. If you take the copy off that book, you'll see that the actual book is 50 Shades of Grey.
Marketing.
Yeah, so I'm sorry about that. We had a series of screw-ups and the book didn't get here. But
you can order it and have it mailed to you.
Okay. Luckily, two of the three are panelists. Their books are outside, and Elizabeth's book is an ebook. And of course, all you have to do is jump onto Amazon to get Elizabeth's book. So let me just take a minute and introduce our panelists, starting with Judy here on my far left, your right. Judith Schwartz, she goes by Judy, is the author of Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heat the Earth.
Heal the Earth,
not sorry. Heal. What did I say? Hurt the Earth. Oh, did I say Hurt the Earth?
Heat.
Oh, Heat the Earth. No, we're doing that on our own, no problem. To Heal the Earth. Which I saw on her page that a reviewer described as a fascinating John McPhee-style journey into the world of soil rehabilitation. That sounded pretty great. It was published by Chelsea Green in May of 2013. Judy is a longtime freelance writer. She has written books. She's written magazine pieces. She writes for newspapers. She does freelance editing. She's also co-written and ghost-written books, which is an interesting topic in and of itself. She's a trained therapist and has written a lot about mental health. She's got she just finished a novel, right? It's not published yet.
Ooh, where are you getting this from?
I'm a trained researcher. Okay.
That's how I connected with my agent, actually.
Right, well, we'll talk about that. She's just written a novel based on her grandmother's psychoanalyst, who was a member of Freud's inner circle in Vienna, so that's pretty cool. Yeah. She's got a BA from Brown and a master's from the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, and she's got an MA in Counseling Psychology from Northwestern. So there's Judy. Thank you, Judy. Next to Judy is Elizabeth McGowan, who worked for Crane Communications in Washington before she joined Inside Climate News, where she worked on staff for a couple of years and still has a relationship with ICN, but is not on staff. Before she was at ICN, she worked for daily papers in Vermont and Wisconsin. Her work really came to prominence with the July 2010 Dilbit spill into the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, and Inside Climate News just really covered the heck out of it. And that work, as many of you know, was ultimately that work and others was rewarded with the National Reporting Prize, the Pulitzer for National Reporting this year, which is really it's the first time that a web startup, well, ProPublica, except for ProPublica, it's the first time that a web startup has won a Pulitzer. So it's really an amazing piece of work. And Elizabeth turned, and Lisa Song and others who participated in that, turned their work into an ebook, which you can get on Amazon as a Kindle single. So it'll be great to hear Elizabeth talk about that process. And then next to me here is Duncan Macillis, who's an attorney with King & Spalding, one of the really big law firms of the South. Actually, it's a national law firm. He's been there since 2006. He focuses on electronic discovery issues. And this writing business was something he sort of did on the side, as he'll explain to us. He has a PhD in history from the University of Georgia, as well as his JD from Duke. And he went to UNC and was an English major. His book is called Ducktown Smoke, The Fight Over One of the South's Greatest Environmental Disasters. It was published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2011. So this, you know, so here's another route, dissertation to academic press to then pushing your book out to a broader audience, which Duncan has done really well. And his book, it's a work of history, but also very much literary nonfiction. It describes the destruction wrought by the Ducktown copper mining concerns in Tennessee, Georgia, and North Carolina in the late 1800s, which led to a really important 1907 Supreme Court case that established Duncan will explain, but it basically established the principle that even if the original environmental insult did not occur in your immediate political subdivision, if it affected you, you did indeed have standing to bring that case to try to contest that environmental injury. So it's a really important piece of law, which Duncan turned into a wonderful piece of narrative nonfiction journalism. So it's a diverse group that we got here. And I thought that what we would do is begin by each of you, and I'll do this too, talk about briefly where the germ of your idea came from, you know, sort of how things started in terms of the specific idea that led to this book. So, Judy, why don't we start with you? How did you get the idea for Cows Save the Planet?
Okay, so a few years ago, I was writing about the nexus of economics and the environment and found that a really, really rich area that I felt was undercovered. So I was at a conference, the Slow Money Conference. I don't know if any of you have heard of the Slow Money Movement. It's kind of interesting. It happened to be up...
Journalists.
I'm sorry?
Bill said, we're journalists. We know all about slow money.
Gotcha.
We go to the no money conference.
Anyway, this is up in Vermont. And at that conference, I encountered a fact that I just found too compelling to ignore. And basically, someone said that over time, more CO2 has gone into the atmosphere from agricultural practices compared to the burning of fossil fuels. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. How come I didn't know that? And how come we don't talk about that? And doesn't that then change the equation of what we're grappling with, and provide opportunities to work with the carbon cycle? Okay, so I got very excited about this, And I was lucky enough at the time to have a couple of editors that were game to let me try ideas that maybe they weren't sure where the pieces were going to go. So I, in my first couple of articles on that for Pacific Standard, which was then Miller McCune, and Time, Time.com, I had to look at, well, how does one return that carbon back into the soil? And that's where I ran into holistic management, holistic planned grazing, which is the use of livestock as a tool for large-scale land restoration. And that's really incredible, rich stuff. I'm not going to go into that. But I ended up writing an article about it. Then Conservation Magazine contacted me to ask me to expand upon that article in what was then Miller McCune. Then, after the conservation article came out, in which I wrote about Alan Savory, who developed holistic management, I got an email from the publisher of Chelsea Green, who said, would you be interested in doing a book on Alan Savory? And I thought, wow, that's kind of an interesting request. But my response was, I don't think I could do that. I also knew the kinds of advances that Chelsea Green paid. My response, and they published that book too, The Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money. So,
they're experts.
Right. So I said, I don't think I could do that justice because here this fellow's been working on this for 40 years. It's a big, long story involving the politics of Zimbabwe and what was then Rhodesia. And I just couldn't do it without spending significant time in Zimbabwe. So I said, however, I've been thinking a lot about soil. Can I come talk to you about that? So drove up to White River Junction, and we had a conversation, and it was like no other conversation I had had with publishers. I don't know how many of you have sat in conference rooms with potential acquisition teams, and this was more like, yeah, this is great. Let's talk about the ideas, the possibilities. And they sent me home, and You know, they said, let's see a proposal. And then, oh, my gosh. Oh, I had an interesting encounter in that discussion. We had all these ideas, and we were so much on the same page, and it was really exciting. And I said, well, so, like, how will this book look? What will be the structure? How do I frame that? And then Margot Baldwin, the publisher, said, that's for you to figure out. Oh, I thought you were going to tell me. And then I asked for a model, and she said, Omnivore's Dilemma. Oh, okay, great. Yeah, this is great. Anyway,
a little bar.
Yeah. So, and what's cool is that Michael Pollan loves this book. He tweeted that it was the most optimistic environmental book that he had read this year. And what's interesting, this is a little aside, is that in terms of book marketing, a tweet from Michael Pollan actually was significant. I mean, you know, like when you think like a tweet.
All right, don't step ahead, Judy. Okay. Don't step ahead.
Anyway, all right.
We'll get there. Okay,
so that's where it happened.
And Elizabeth, your book also, like Judy's, it wasn't originally even thought of as a book. It arose sort of organically out of your reporting at Inside Climate.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to stand, if that's okay. I don't know, I sit too much. I drove to Chattanooga yesterday, and I need to walk around. So, yeah, I mean, I went to the University of Missouri in Columbia. I'm giving them a shout-out because, you know, schools do play a role in modeling who we are. And the message was always, keep it short, because everybody has a short attention span. So the idea of writing a book, I'm like, really? A book can be, you know, 700 words? So, or fewer. But anyway, with this, the genesis of this is, you know, I had worked in daily newspapers. I'd done a lot of things. I'm a self-taught energy and environment reporter. So I had found Inside Climate News on the web. I did some freelance work for them, and one day David Sassoon, the publisher, called me and said, "Hey, Elizabeth, we got some foundation money. It's enough to pay you for a year. Do you want to be full-time? You know, we like your part-time work." Sure. So, you know, basically in 3 days, I was on a plane trying to...
desperately trying to...
Should I be quiet?
Yeah, I think that's my publisher. They just realized they were supposed to. All right. Let's keep going.
So what happened was I was covering the elections from an Energy and Environment Commission in 2010. So I looked at a map, selected some areas, and one area that there was nascent bubbling in was Nebraska, the Keystone XL pipeline, right? So I went out there. I realized that the people were making it an issue. The politicians were basically giving it the Heisman. They didn't want to talk about it. It was off the charts, except for a few guys who were going to get about 17 votes, you know, who, of course, were open to being interviewed. So anyway, blah, blah, we wrote stories, and then after the election passed, we realized we're a tiny organization, you know, we got 4 or 5 people on staff, we have some freelancers, we've got to develop a niche. So we changed our name, became Inside Climate News. It really should have been Inside Pipeline News, the internal joke, because we started writing about this so that we covered the heck out of the Keystone XL. Then we hired a new editor. She had worked at ProPublica. She had experience in e-books, but e-books I didn't even think about. So we started working on this project. She said, "You know, Elizabeth, there was that spill up in Michigan in the Kalamazoo River. We got to look into that." And that meant me. So I live in Washington, D.C. I went to Michigan. I stomped around. You know, it's the shoe leather journalism stuff. Asking questions. I did my due diligence. I found some wonderful people. I did a lot of interviewing. I got back to D.C. We had a conference call about it. And my publisher said, "Well, Elizabeth, you know, that sounds like a story and a sidebar." I said, "Okay." And the other editor, she and I had been talking, and everyone else, and she called me. She's like, "Elizabeth, it's not a story and a sidebar. It's a long narrative project." I'm like, "All right, I'm in." So we started working together on this. We were back and forth, the two of us. And she's in California, and I'm on the East Coast, and she has no ability to tell time because she was always calling me at 11 o'clock at night. "Well, you didn't answer the phone." I'm like, "Well, I was in bed." Right? I mean, honestly, so it's interesting because it's a virtual newsroom, but we worked and worked and worked on this project. We brought in Lisa Song later because it got so huge with the science on the health. We were looking at health issues. We look at the science of diluted bitumen. There was no place you could go to find information on this, so we were cobbling it together ourselves, and I'm putting together this narrative. So that's what we worked, and Lisa would do the help us with the science and confirm the anecdotal stuff I had. So it's kind of a merging of the older journalism with the, you know, going out and talking to the people and putting things together, and then, you know, the new people who love to do the pivot charts and the Excel and having a convergence on that. That was helpful. So, you know, then we worked on this for 7 or 8 months, and then we published it. And we basically formatted our own ebook because the powers that be thought it would be another avenue. I mean, you could read this thing for free on our website because we're sponsored by foundations, but the ebook was just another way to reach people with this dilbit. It's just another avenue. And we can talk more about that.
We'll get that.
The genesis for what we did.
So that's great. You can see that there's a trend here, and that is that nobody really set out specifically to write a book, at least not necessarily. Which is actually a pretty good strategy. For reasons I'll explain. Duncan took it another route that is often that you actually see pretty often, and that is it arose this the Ducktown book arose out of his academic work. He also had the good fortune to have another job. He's an attorney. So that can slow things down, but it can also create a level of security that would encourage you to plunge into these kind of projects. So, Duncan, you know, briefly tell us how you got this idea and how early on you thought about it as a book.
Actually, I was intrigued by the scene before I thought about doing a book. Ducktown is right at the Georgia-Tennessee border, almost at the corner of North Carolina. And anybody driving up that way from Atlanta expects to see rounded mountains, beautiful hardwood forests, and all the things that go with it. But when you cross the Ocoee River in downtown Copper Hill and then come around the corner, you realize you're in a different place. Until recently, there was a gigantic smelting complex for Tennessee Copper Company on top of a bluff made out of slag, railroad tracks everywhere that were used to haul sulfuric acid out of the Ducktown Basin to distant markets. And then you round the corner from Ducktown and the woods. Nowadays, you've got these Opi-Jack pines because that's all that grows there. But there were no woods, just bare hills, heavily denuded, mining buildings scattered hither and yon. And then I went up to the Ducktown Basin Museum, which is on the side of one of the Burra Burra copper mine. And even there, it's arresting. It sits on a high hill. You can see the entire copper basin. But right at the edge of the parking lot, there's a cliff. Why? Because they did so much underground mining, everything collapsed. But the museum did it. It's a fine community museum. And I thought, well, I've seen something different. I don't know what to do with it. And then, after many, many years of practicing law, I decided to take a detour. And I went cold turkey. I went in about 4 or 5 years working on a PhD at Georgia. And one of my favorite professors was an environmental law professor, ran an excellent course, Paul Sutter. And when it came time to be thinking about what to write about and pull these things together, well, I'm a lawyer. I understand that just the same way a medical professional can look at a medical chart and see things that a layman might not. I could see things in case documents. But that wasn't enough. In fact, I started working on one project and it bored me to tears. But I kept running across these documents in the Georgia archives. They were letters in the governor's correspondence around the turn of the century, that is, the other turn of the century, 100 years ago. And it kept having scribbled notes on top, Ducktown, Ducktown, Ducktown. And I saw, did a little more exploration and realized, I've been there. And there was a gigantic controversy there. And all of a sudden, things started coalescing. This is an enormously important environmental story. It was also an enormously important legal story. In fact, the case that arose out of all this litigation, Georgia versus Tennessee Copper Company, 1907, is the very first U.S. Supreme Court air pollution case. It was important then because it made law in a number of different ways. And it was also important exactly 100 years later in 2007 because that case was cited as the essential legal precedent to give Massachusetts and the other states standing to litigate against the EPA for their failure to regulate tailpipe emissions. So from Georgia versus Tennessee Copper Company, a case that arose out of 200 different little lawsuits filed by Mountaineer farmers, then 100 years later to Massachusetts versus EPA.
Duncan, you actually don't mean tailpipe emissions, right? You mean to regulate CO2
yes.
a criteria pollutant under the
clear. Right. But the point of it all was that there was another thing that intrigued me, both as a lawyer and as a budding historian. I found out the museum had a cache of documents that nobody had examined. These documents had been laying, their old company corporate documents for the two main copper companies, they've been moldering under a leaky roof in an abandoned company store. The museum rescued them because they were about to be chunked down a mine shaft as rubbish. So the museum boxed them up, dried them out, And then when I convinced the director, Ken Rush, what I was up to, he started bringing these boxes out one by one, set me on a folding table just like this in a display room of the museum. Now, these records are in horrible shape. I was dusting off mildew, pulling out rusted fasteners, hoping my tetanus shots were up to date. But I was seeing the stuff that is behind the scenes on a lawsuit, the stuff that never gets into the appellate record because it's just too hidden. I see how the corporate lawyers, one of the most important insights I saw there was when the corporate lawyers announced their strategy to corporate management, say, we have a strategy of keeping a blocked docket. They knew they would lose if a farmer's managed to get to a jury. And so their job was not to try the case on the merits, but to do every procedural trick they knew to keep these cases from ever reaching that.
Yeah, I'm shocked to hear that they would take that.
I have seen it done.
So the point is, Duncan, that you, from the very beginning, did you see this as a nonfiction narrative, or was it more just that you were intrigued by the idea and you were just curious and you wanted to know more?
It was curiosity coupled with the fact that I needed a good dissertation topic, right, and a blended environment, mm-hmm, law, and I had some tools to be able to work it, and nobody had written on it. Nobody had done a book-length study on that, and it just flabbergasted me.
Great. So in my case, the idea of the Tom Zitter book really also arose out of my own reporting that I had done for Newsday, where, you know, every time I wrote about cancer patterns, as I had for 20-plus years, it was just so, it just resonated obviously so strongly with readers. I would get incredible reactions from people and tremendous amount of fear and very intense emotions. And the more I wrote about it, well, the more political pandering there was in New York, and people were running around authorizing millions of dollars to do epidemiological work that was really not very good. And ultimately, I would write about these studies that my own reporting had sort of ginned up, you know, and helped to create. And I was so disappointed by the outcome and the feeling that, well, we're not really learning anything here, and this is really bad science. It's politically driven science. And there was just sort of a great feeling of frustration that I had not served, that the readers were just, they were so passionate about this, they really wanted to understand, you know, this, try to unpack this very complicated question of to what extent does where you live influence your risk of getting this sort of family of diseases that we call cancer, even though it's 300-plus diseases. And so I felt like I really wanted to figure out a way to tell that story better. And while I was still at Newsday, I heard about this town down in New Jersey where a really interesting piece of science had been done. And I actually went down there to cover it when the study was released. And I thought, well, this is interesting, because all the things that we really screwed up in New York, you know, in terms of the politics and the science, eventually it was done correctly down here in New Jersey. And the characters were fascinating, and I learned a little bit about the history, although not a lot. But to me, it felt like an opera, like a fully formed saga. You know, if you were looking around for sort of a classic narrative, It felt like that. That felt like one to me. So I just sort of tucked that away in the back of my mind and said, you know, I would like to get back to this narrative someday. And so then when I left Newsday and took my NYU job, I, you know, immediately they're pressuring you. If you want tenure, you need to get an idea, you need to publish. And that was fine, because I wanted to do that anyway. And I immediately thought of this. And so I had an agent on it. We'll talk about agents in a second, but, you know, I was thinking about the problem before I was thinking about the book. You know, I was thinking about, gee, this, which is something I really recommend, that you actually think about your readers. What might your readers really, what do your readers need? What are they worked up about? What are they excited about? Instead of only thinking about, gee, I really want to write a book. What book will I write? The best books seem to sort of arise organically out of a frustration, a problem, a need that's not being met. And I think that's a kind of a common thread of all four of us. So before we move on to the next stage, which is sort of taking your idea and figuring out, okay, let's make this idea an actual book. Does anybody, you know, shall we move on now that we've captured your attention, or does anybody, just feel free to raise your hand if at various points you've got, you want more information or clarification. Yeah, Jeff.
I was wondering from Duncan, what was the process of getting from a dissertation, probably written in a fairly academic voice, to a book that could go to a wider audience?
So Joe's asking, how do you go from a dissertation, a very sort of academic focus, to a broader approach designed for a broad audience that could be published commercially? And that's actually a great question to segue to our next phase, which is about exactly that. Okay, you've got the idea. You've got something that you're excited about. That doesn't mean that you have a book. You know, then you have to think about, does that really make a book? And it usually means writing some kind of a proposal, although not necessarily in Duncan's case. So Duncan, why don't you take it from there, and then we'll, others will chime in too. This is sort of step two, where we are now.
The quickest answer is that I had a strong committee, and they told me right up front, write your dissertation as if it were a book. And that vastly smoothed out the process of transition. And I took that one step further. I thought about all the history books I read while getting my degree and thought some are unreadable, others are very attractive, as well as being high-quality scholarship. And the thread that kept running through those is typically books that had a good narrative. And then the third was to say that while I've got three audiences to write for, professional historians, legal scholars, since the book is now being used in law schools, I also wanted to write a book that was accessible to the intelligent general reader. And my wife, Teresa, neatly fit that role. She's not terribly fond of history, and she's certainly not fond of law. But she's highly... Exactly. In heaven, the lion will lie down with the lamb. In hell, there would be ceaseless litigation with scrupulous observation of due process rights.
Right.
But she was my test, and she also does a lot of editing on her own. So that gave me a measure. If something didn't mesh with her, if she kept saying, what are you saying? What does this mean? I don't get it. I took those questions as being extremely valid, and I would write until they quit being asked.
So Judy, how about you? When we last left Judy, she was walking out of Chelsea Green Publishing in the fine town of White River Junction, Vermont, a wonderful town, good restaurants there, and she was given the strict marching orders that you need to write the next Omnivore's Dilemma. So Judy, your next task, besides just having a stiff drink or something, would be to figure out some kind of plan for the book, some kind of structure. And did you write a formal proposal, or at this point did you have enough from Chelsea Green that you felt like you could just go?
Okay, so in that discussion, the acquiring editor said something that ended up laying it out for me. She said, you could just hit every horrible problem we're dealing with, climate change, desertification, floods, droughts, and wildfires, biodiversity loss, etc., and show how soil fits in and how soil restoration can turn things around. So, and basically how those concerns pivot on the soil. So that ended up laying it out for me. Okay, so they asked for a proposal. I wrote 13 pages, which ended up being almost word for word my introduction and a chapter outline, which was very straightforward. Now, for me, the challenge was the tone. How do you interest a general audience in soil? So basically what happened for me was the title set the tone, all right? And I'll tell you how I came up with this title. You know, I was wondering, okay, I knew I couldn't have a title like Soil is Really Important. You know, you should know this, okay? You know, I mean, I just knew that there were so many titles that I couldn't use. So, and I knew it was important. So, at my house, I was just, you know, straightening up, and there was a pile of books that my son had been reading. And my son, being of the generation, he just started college, the kinds of books he was reading were comic books. A Gary Larson book. There's a Gary Larson book called Cows of Our Planet.
Right.
So this book was sitting there. I thought, Cows of Our Planet. Cows save the planet. I got it. And that was so important because that did set the tone of being kind of disarming to the reader. It set that this book is not going to tell you what you think you already know. We're gonna be a little playful. We're going to surprise you. And there it went.
Great. Yeah, Jean.
I think this is the right time for this question.
Sorry, I didn't mean to intimidate you. If you're not sure, just ask.
As all of you were working on your projects, how did you organize your material, and were there any tools and or strategies that became really important so that you weren't spending whole days looking for material for chapter X, Y? How did
that
you
organize? That is a great question. It's slightly premature because we're not really... Don't let that stop you from asking. Yes, Nancy.
I know I have a really short thing to say, but I'd like to know how you go about organizing your books.
Yeah, organizing your book. Oh, okay. That is also premature. but please keep asking questions. No, that is really important, and we're going to spend time on that. But it actually, the reason it's premature is that I think that some authors make the mistake of really jumping ahead and trying to write the book before they've really, trying to write the book sort of chapter by chapter before they have a sense of the coherent whole. And with a book, you really do have to map out the coherent whole before you just start writing. Yeah, Tim.
Well, maybe this one is really timely. Do you have an agent, or are you dealing directly with a publisher?
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because Judy, in your case, even though Judy had a very interested publisher, she did something very smart, which is that she brought in an agent, which is, I really do strongly recommend, for multiple reasons, an agent will take their 15%, but... an agent, it's great to have somebody within the business whose interests pretty much coincide with yours, you know. You don't have to think quite so mercenarily because your agent can think that way for you. And it can be very helpful in many ways, including just from just sheer experience. It's great to have somebody who's been through this multiple times. So that's what you did, right, Judy? You brought in an agent. And the book wasn't shot. It was clear that it was going to be Chelsea Green. But even in that case, where there's not going to be an auction, it is pretty important to have an agent. Now, in Elizabeth's case, it wouldn't make sense to have an agent. Because it was straight to Kindle single, and this was Inside Climate News would essentially act as the publisher. You know, when you do a Kindle single, you know, Amazon keeps a piece, but you know, you get the rest.
Which doesn't come to me directly; it goes to our organization. Yeah.
Right. This is another new model where Elizabeth Elizabeth did all that reporting work as a staff person for Inside Climate News, and so the deal was that Inside Climate News would take the book. Now, in your case, Duncan, in the academic route, did you use an agent or not?
I didn't use an agent.
But he's a lawyer.
When it came to writing books, I found a babe in the woods, but... The custom course in academic and writing dissertations is to get published by a strong academic press. And it happened at my alma mater, UNC Chapel Hill, was a strong one. And their reps would circulate once in a while, and I mentioned my project to them, and they expressed a great deal of interest and told me to send a dissertation up to them when it was accepted. So that goes that way. Picking a press because they know how to handle the academic publication route, and they're considered a good press.
Let me just answer that, and we'll keep going. I think I took the most conventional, old-fashioned way. I took sort of the commercial route where you get an agent and you have an auction. And I had this agent for a long time, ever since I sort of had... My first book that was done with a nonprofit, with the Center for Public Integrity, we did not use an agent. It was almost like Elizabeth's deal, except you know, my author and I did a lot of work beyond what we had done for the center, and so we did get paid. So that was one difference. But this time. I had been talking to my agent about various ideas over the years, and I had even written a proposal for one, but I told her not even to try to sell it because I thought it turned out to be a dumb idea. One of the great reasons to write a proposal is that you realize, do I really love this idea as much as I thought I did? But if you get an agent, which I did, and you decide to go the conventional route, the agent will make you write a formal proposal. Now, Judy's proposal of just 13 pages, that would be very unusual in a typical conventional commercial publishing arrangement. My proposal was more typical, and it was 70 pages. It's very structured if you decide to go this conventional route, where you will write a sample chapter, you will write a... table of contents, an annotated table of contents, where you'll give a summary of each chapter. You will write a sort of a juicy introduction to really grab people, and you'll even do what they call a marketing section. Publishing, conventional commercial publishing, is a lot like the movies that, you know, you have to, everything has to relate to something that's already been done. You know, you have to say, It's the Three Stooges meets Naked King the Stranger meets Twilight, you know. I mean, it, whatever. Everything has to relate to something else. So you have to be explicit about that and say, okay, my book is similar to this book. Here's how my book is different. And you want to pick out books that have been successful and sort of show how your book is like that. And the agent helps you do that. And so that's what I did. And then you get to the stage where you are looking for a publisher, and the agent plays a key role in helping you look for a publisher. And you do all this, if you decide to go the conventional route, you do all this before you've actually written almost anything except maybe anything for the final book except maybe one sample chapter. So that's why those questions are a little premature for the conventional. Yeah, Lizzie. Then Lizzie. Go ahead, Chris.
One sample chapter? I've heard 2 to 3.
Some people like more. I did one. Yeah, I think the agent will tell you, you know. I think it depends on what kind of book it is. But yeah. Yeah, Lizzie.
And I was just going to chime in that in my cases of books that I wanted to write, I was going to have to go out and do substantial on-the-ground research for all of my chapters, and that wasn't going to be possible to write one whole standalone chapter. So I kind of went more a combination of Judy and Dan's route and concentrated on the introduction and the annotated outline, and wherever I had material, I would pull in as good material as I could from the articles I'd written that were feeding into the book, because it really wasn't possible outside of like the introductory chapter that was going to hopefully give the arc of the whole premise of what I was doing. I couldn't have written up two or three whole chapters without embarking on more research than I could have done, so I kind of did a combo of the two, so that's another process.
Yeah, I guess for Judy, I just wanted you to flesh out a bit more sort of what are the ethical, strategic, and I'm sure economic decisions in going from that flirtation, meaning Chelsea Green courted you, and you locked into Chelsea Green, whereas you could also, right, say, all right, I'll give you 13 pages, 20 pages, but still with your agent shop it around.
Oh.
Where does it come? I guess it's probably different for each publisher, but does there come a point where you are locked in?
Oh, I wasn't locked in. I could have taken it anywhere. Margot Baldwin, who's a really, really smart woman, the publisher, she said, you could take this around. No one else is going to walk this. And I believed her. I really believed her. I also knew the quality of their books.
Yeah.
And and I just really, really felt that they would do a good job with it. And I was right.
We would have liked it.
All right.
It's a funny thing, this business of sort of finding a publisher that you're comfortable with. If you take the conventional route, like I did, and then your agent will definitely want to shop it, because the more money you get on your advance, the more the agent gets. Mm-hmm. So you go through this kind of hideous process of working on this proposal, then you're waiting for the phone to ring and the agent to tell you who's interested and how much are they willing to bid, or they want to meet with you. And sometimes they will call you. You'll have this sort of weird kind of game show thing going on, where you're going from place to place and sort of, you don't, on the one hand, you're telling them about your book and trying to get them interested. On the other hand, they're telling you about what they want to do with your book. And half the time, they tell you things and you're like, I don't care how much you bid, I'm not interested. So if the conventional route, there's what they call an auction, although it's not like people are saying, how much for this, fine piece of horse flesh. But that's what happens. Jim, no one.
Yeah, from Brothers Courage Journal a little. Could you give me some sort of idea of the kind of ranges of what kind of advances can be expected for science and environmental?
Yeah. You can't count that high, Jim. you guys want to take a stab at that before I do?
I can't because I don't know.
Well, advances are a really weird thing, okay? Because Chelsea Green does, let us say, modest advances. How's that? Okay.
Does that mean four figures or five? What does that mean?
Right. Okay, this was very, very low five.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. But the thing is that, okay, there are just a lot of dynamics there, because you could get a high advance, and then if they don't support the book and it doesn't sell, then they're not happy with you.
Right. It's hard to do the next one if you really disappoint them.
Right. So what with Chelsea Green, it was really low expectations. But the other thing is that where they didn't put money into the advance, they put a lot of resources into the marketing and selling and supporting of the book.
Which we'll get to.
Yeah,
so it really is a balance. And if you go the academic route, also the advances are pretty low, typically.
I think the reality, working with an academic press, especially if you're fresh out of school and you want to get your first book published, is that you need them more than they need you. And that's the way it's handled. So, no. no advance. Yeah. There was a royalty contract, and to get the benefit of working with a press that is used to guiding rookie authors through the process. So that's the quid pro quo.
I would say that for there are ranges for different kinds of books that, you know, the academic press is usually, you know, quite low, and then more the sort of small house, nonprofit type advances, you know, would be in the low five figures, occasionally less. And then the commercial route, you know, it could be as, you know, it could be $25,000, well into six figures, and with just amazing luck and timing and interest of multiple publishers, it could be significantly up into the six figures. And of course, the whole thing is really how the commercial potential of your idea. You know, that's all they care about. It's in terms of commercial publishers, like what I was pitching to, that's their focus, and they're very honest about that. They're like, oh yeah, that would be great if you win some prizes or get some good reviews, but what we're really interested in is will it sell? And that obviously can affect the product. It can affect your enjoyment of the process and how you feel about your work. If you go, Judy, if you go either of these three routes for different reasons, you are likely to be asked to compromise less. If you go try to go for the higher advance, you're gonna need to think much more about the marketplace and get, you know, the expectation is that you will sell significant numbers of books, and so that means that you may have to make some compromises. Yes. Oh, go ahead, Francesca.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead too much, but I wanted to know about whether your decision to go with publishers you went to, in addition to the marketing aspect that you were referring to, was the print run that you might have, the distribution that you might have, whether it was, you know, run at 5,000, 10,000, I know more in your case probably than I wondered if that was part of a factor in your decision. And so, you know, what was the, how much was the runs for the distribution for each of these books?
Do you know what your
opinion was? Yeah, I do know, yeah. I mean, the funny thing about it, Francesca, and I didn't know this when I got into it, is they don't tell you how many books they're going to print. And the reason is that the way it works these days is it's very easy to print more books, at least for the big houses. It's very easy for them to just go back and order more books. But what they really don't want to do is they don't want to get caught with a lot of books that they printed and didn't sell. So there's no sort of guarantee, at least in any contract that I've ever seen, there's no guaranteed press run. You know, the agent will try to find out. But it's the publisher has latitude to print as many or as few as they want. And you would be shocked at how low some press runs are for well-known books. You'd be shocked. Sometimes books sell less. Books that you know of has sell less than 1,000 copies, So in my case, they started out with a relatively low run. I think the first run was 5,000 copies or something. And then they run more and more. And so I'm on my third run now. No, the other increments were a little larger. They just sort of take it step by step, and you just kind of see how it goes, you know? And it's that kind of business where unless you sort of break through and you're a star author that everybody knows, not everybody knows as in, you know, respects, but everybody knows as in, wow, that's a best-selling author, then the numbers can be really low. I don't know. Does anybody else want to talk about that? Yeah. Find out.
I mean, I know the print run. They did 4,000 initially in May, and then they reprinted. It went into reprinting in July. 3,000, and I think they'll probably do another soon.
Okay.
The academic press. Do you know what?
Yeah. What they, you know what your run was, though?
I don't know what the run is, but I do know that they publish in hard copy, and immediately there's a designated list of university and college libraries that it goes to.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. And I find one factor that plays on this is that, given the economics of the academic press route, frankly, these hardcover books are expensive.
Yeah.
And it has a different dynamic to it than it would in other circumstances.
Yeah, libraries, we're jumping ahead here, but the library run, which is the initial run, is often, for a serious book, is often largely determined by how much interest there is from institutions, libraries especially, and that is largely determined by reviews in the trade press. So the trade press reviews, Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, Booklist, that, you know, those are really important. Okay, we got multiple questions. Yes.
How did you project your ebook sales?
Yeah, I didn't project anything. You know, I was surprised that I sold more. 40% of my total sales are in ebooks, and I did not expect that. I didn't think it would be that high. They don't tell you. It just kind of happens. Some publishers will allow you to sort of log on and see. It's a kind of an indirect measure, but you can get a sense of your overall sales and how they're changing from week to week and what percentage is ebook. And at least Random House lets you do that. I don't know if all those do.
I was just
going to
say, if you
want
a rule of thumb, you can look at 12-17% will probably be ebook sales.
What percent?
12-17.
Yeah, mine was.
It's going up to 100% anyway. So.
Yeah. Yeah, mine was a lot higher than that, but I think that's unusual. Yes.
I was wondering if Elizabeth could talk a little bit more about her arrangement with Kindle, how that worked. Did she have to pitch Kindle, or is it just Kindle is such a commercial enterprise that it's like, you know, it's just some kind of transaction that you do with them?
The Diluted by Tomb and the first book that came out was our first ebook. So we, I guess you could say we sort of met halfway with them. I wasn't really in on the, you know, any of those conversations. We had somebody helping us with the formatting because it's pretty laborious. I mean, we're solely a digital publication, but we couldn't just take what we had and send it to them and say, format it in what you do. Our editors were doing that, which is really tedious. And we, for this special project, because we're such a tiny staff, fortunately, we had hired a graphic editor, so we could create some kind of a cover. We had maps. We had some illustrations with captions. But we really drove the train on that one and made this thing. And Amazon, you know, took. I mean, you go through this kind of weird little contract thing. There's this hidden place online that you click on, and that starts the process, so that you are registered with them to do the book. And then since then, Inside Climate News has done another ebook, and I think that one went more smoothly just because we sort of knew what we were doing. This was almost an afterthought because we'd been working on this project, and the key was to publish it, have everything accurate, and, you know, we'd never done anything like this before. This was a huge project. So we did drive the train on the first one, and then it's quite frankly kind of surprised. I mean, the fact that any of them sold amazed me. I mean, look, I'll be honest with you, because I had no idea what to expect. I just, you know, we were catering to this niche audience with this energy information, and we were writing, you know, we were doing journalism. In other words, like passing the Teresa sniff test, like he was talking about. I mean, we had people who know enough, but you still had to invite in the people who didn't know, who hadn't read the past stuff and maybe heard about this and thought, oh, I should read this. So it was, you know, blending the narrative with this and weaving the science in so that isn't this big oily thing that drops in the middle of it. So, you know, yeah, people will parse their way through journalism for that, but will they do it in a book? So we were kind of, it was an experiment is what it was.
Do the Amazon have to accept you, or was it?
Yeah.
They do have to accept.
They do have to accept you. Yeah. But you have to do, we did all the legwork, and then they basically nodded their heads and said, yeah, accepted
they
us.
They do say no. It's not the kind of deal like a self-publishing thing.
Oh,
you
okay.
Can just,
yeah,
so we couldn't just shovel anything upon them. There had to be, but they said sometimes they will help you more. But with our first one, they were like, if you deliver something, we'll give you a yes or a no, basically is what.
So I do want to sort of keep moving, because we haven't even gotten to the, you know, here's how you organize your book. But maybe if we have any more questions about sort of the agent sales, but let's do a lightning round. Yeah.
Really quickly, just on the advance. What about the trade division of academic press, like Yale University Press? They seem to be, from what I've heard, and a couple editors are comparable with some of the commercial runs. But what would you expect? What sort of range of advances from that kind of division?
I'm trying to be humble about this because they didn't know me. I've never published a book, and so I was. From the viewpoint of a press, I'm a new author coming into this, and I had to convince them. So I'm sure I have seen those kinds of things, the trade arms of the academic presses, but I frankly don't think they deal with people like me.
Yeah, my understanding is that those advances are not, even those advances, you know, from, you know, Oxford or Yale, or the, you know, the people that do more commercially aimed books, they're still not very big. But I might be wrong about that. All right, real quick ones, and then we'll... Yes?
Can I weigh in prematurely as an academic publisher or publisher?
Yeah, quickly, though.
But, yes, most university presses have a trade publishing division, and depending on their resources, they will pay advances of some kind. I would recommend to authors that they focus more on the royalty rate they're getting paid to actually earn on the book. And I would be curious to know how many of those of you who have published a book have their book is earned back the advance. I mean, it sounds like you've got some very successful books here.
Yeah.
Have you gone beyond that initial advance yet, or are you still?
I have not.
I haven't checked.
I mean, the percent. The question is, have you earned back on your advance? And amazingly, a shockingly small part of a percentage of commercial publications earned back, but it does happen. Sounds like Lizzie might have.
Yeah, I feel about very similar to Judy. I've done two books with Island Press, and my first book with them had an advance, I think, in the realm of what Judy got. I earned about my advance in the first royalty period, and I've earned advance ever since.
All right. Bravo, Lizzie. Yeah.
And, I wouldn't have done it if I had an advance from the lift off. But it was in the low for 5 years.
What you really don't want to do as an author is you don't want to disappoint your publisher, because the publishers will know what your previous advances have been. They do share that information. If you get a big advance, you really want to try hard to deliver, because otherwise the next one you will get a much smaller advance, if at all. So. Yeah, but let's keep going though. But yeah, okay, go ahead, Francesca.
I just made one other statement, which is that sometimes the trade divisions of academic publishers will allow grants. If you can get grant money, you can supplement.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. All right, yeah, Chrissy, then we go.
I just wonder what these savory compromises are.
Yeah, well, it's never that explicit, you know, but certainly your editor, say you go the commercial route, you'll be assigned an editor. In my case, my project took so long that and there's so much turmoil in big time publishing that I ultimately have four editors. The previous three were either fired or retired or took another job. It's like, you know, King Henry VIII is divorced, beheaded, resigned, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. In my case, it's retired, fired, quit, survived. So those editors will be the ones that are sort of, they're your buffer, but they're the ones getting the pressure to sort of say, okay, we need this to be a commercial book. And then your editor will handle that with you and sort of say, well, here's what we think you should be doing. So that maybe is a good segue to the research and writing phase, like Judy had asked and others, which is that, okay, you've got this project, and now you somehow, and you've got an overall plan of some sort, an accepted proposal, a contract. Now you need to somehow shape a book. And you have your overall guide, but reality sets in, you start doing more actual reporting and things change, and it's very hard to sort of keep your eye on the ball and try to sort of shape the whole thing. So maybe, Judy, you could start with that and sort of deal with this question of organization, you know. But again, we don't have a lot of time.
Right, so, okay. Yeah. Okay, really quickly. I wrote my book in a year. For a few months beforehand, I'd been thinking about it, and I'd written a few pieces that really moved me towards the book. With the proposal, I had a chapter outline. I absolutely held to that, except one chapter, the climate chapter, became two chapters, and then one topic I ended up not dealing with. Okay, so I had the template, so it was a matter of filling it in. So I just read, researched, called, etc., and just had different files on the computer. This is about desertification. This is about biodiversity. So all that. And then I got to jump into this. So I did a couple of reporting trips for the early chapters. I just plowed in.
For efficiency's sake, it's important to work on multiple things at once, you know, because you're going to be waiting for key interviews or reporting trips to come through. And so when you're at that stage now, I mean, some people use great software. Scribd is one that a lot of people use to sort of organize. Scribd, right? Is that what it is? Scribner, sorry. That ways to sort of organize complex book projects, specifically for a book project. I didn't use that. I just, would create multiple files in Word, like Judy did. And I would just have a plan for every day. This is what I want to get done. And then I would have sort of a micro plan for the day, and then I would have a sort of a macro plan for month by month what I felt like I needed to do. And Elizabeth, this is kind of irrelevant to you because your work, most of it was already done.
Right.
But did you have to do much sort of massaging with the content itself to get it into the ebook form?
Because we ran it as a series, what we had to go do is go back into each day and make sure that we weren't repeating. Because with the series, we wanted to repeat key information so the reader didn't have to go back to day one, because I think it was a four-part series. So right. It was that kind of massaging. But I think the luxury that we had is that we didn't know we were writing a book. So we didn't have to think about that. We were doing a journalism project.
That is a good one.
And we were getting everything. I mean, it's the same thing. I did a very rough narrative, and then we started filling in the blanks, and we decided what we were going to keep in, what was going to go out, and we were doing this as the day of the spill in the Kalamazoo River up until, Enbridge was deciding to repair the line that had burst or relocate the line that had burst and would be carrying more diluted bitumen through the same area. So it's the same kind of thinking. It was just maybe more compressed because it was 7 months, but we still had to think all those through. You know, I had the luxury of having that editor available all the time just for me. So we were back and forth. I mean, I can't tell you how many hours I was on the phone for 7 months. I had a, receiver growing out of my ear. So in addition to filling in all the reporting blanks, I mean, things that we didn't even know to ask the first month we were scrambling to find. So it was the same thing. We just didn't think about it like the panic of a book. It was the panic of another deadline with an article.
That's an important thing to remember, too, is that books take a long time. Mm-hmm. It's not, especially if you come from a daily journalism orientation. You forget, and things change throughout the course of reporting the book, and you will find yourself having to go back and change things
right.
that you had written a year or 2 years earlier, an earlier chapter. You're, So there's a sense of constant revision that you don't
right.
necessarily get if you came from daily journalism.
Right.
Now, how about you, Duncan? How did you, organize your process? You didn't really have a separate process for dissertation and book. Your dissertation was the book, essentially. You didn't go through it twice.
Yes. In fact, because of the good advice I had at the dissertation stage, my chapter structure remained intact when it was transformed into a
wow.
book. And they did ask me to write a conclusory chapter, but the structure had been thought out earlier. For me, the two things I wanted to do, the approaches I had, one was to identify key questions. For instance, why is it that Georgia, which was no more enlightened on environmental issues in 1907 than any other state, ended up being the plaintiff in the first Supreme Court air pollution case? It's counterintuitive. So some things I knew up front were questions that had to be answered. But the other thing is that I am an omnivore when it comes to data. I want to see it all. I copied everything without much regard to whether it was important or less important because I didn't know the links. But I knew that if I took all those original documents, copied them properly, put them in chrono order, which is the main thing for me, and then I started drafting indexes just by chronological order because that allowed me to begin to see the ties that I didn't anticipate up front and to figure out how they fit together. They would answer some questions and it would generate new ones.
Mm-hmm.
For example, this is a case about copper smoke pollution, desertification of Ducktown. That much I knew going into it. It's on the cover of the book. What I didn't know going in was that Georgia lacked a legal theme that was viable for the Supreme Court, and they didn't have it until there was a peculiar nexus of a letter written by Will Shippen, who was an industrial logger, I mean a big one, who had connected with field scientists, foresters from the U.S. Forest Service as they were doing their southern survey of the southern Appalachian forest. This was in the first decade of the last century, and that Will then sent a copy of that letter to Georgia's Attorney General and said, these guys are researching the forest here. You need to be in touch with them. Logger, Federal Forest Science, the Attorney General who needed this information. And this case no longer became a matter of just a smoke case. It became the confluence of the great effort to save the national forest that led to the Weeks Act in 1911. There was that letter. And seeing, pulling that data, putting in chrono order, and making the index, I had one binder called the Book of Lists. And that's what kept me mapping throughout this case.
So we only got about 10 more minutes. I want to make sure that we talk about marketing, but maybe we can do one or two very fast questions about the organization stage, but like lightning round. Yeah.
I did a lot of like heavy document research projects. Did you use any software or methods for, I guess, lawyers are good at organizing big boxes of files, mm-hmm. I was mentioned, but how did you keep track of all that?
I started this before joining my current firm. If I had done it back, had what I have now back then, I would have used a program called CaseMap.
Oh.
That's how lawyers pin documents to chronologies.
Oh.
I did it the hard way with Word and tables.
Yeah. I know famous authors who still put index cards on the wall and you know, sort of bulletin board them. Yes.
Any of the authors tape recording your interviews and then you do a verbatim transcript?
Yeah. Yeah, boy, that is a, talk about a time suck. That is
mm-hmm.
serious.
Or maybe
yeah.
is there software now that automatically does
yeah, it? Well, there is Dragon and other software that keeps getting better and better. I personally just don't feel comfortable with Dragon. It's never really worked well for me.
Do you record your interviews?
I record the important ones. And I record them more for protection and reference that I do. I almost never transcript my interviews because it is so incredibly time consuming. But I try to record the important ones just so I have a record. And I will sort of log the numbers, you know, the scroll numbers, so I can always go back and find and check a particular quote or a particular fact. I am opposed to transcripting. I think it's so incredibly time-consuming. How about you guys? Do you transcript?
I have, not for everything, but I have. Yeah. Like if when I'm interviewing Enbridge executives and there are four of them in the room and one of me,
that's different.
I do that. Yeah. and transcribe. Yeah. And it's tedious. It's a huge time suck, but it's worth it in certain circumstances.
Yeah. How about you, Judy? Do you transcribe?
I don't record.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm kind of a technophobe, but also for this kind of work that I did, it's more of an ongoing conversation with sources, so I'm continually checking in with them.
I think there are lots of reasons that people over record. Yes.
I was curious. Like, when do you know when is it enough? When do you stop? Your deadline?
It's never.
You can always.
Yeah. You mean when you stop researching or writing or all of the above?
All of the above.
Yeah, that's a classic journalism conundrum. We used to always say that, you know you should stop when you run into yourself, you know, when you keep bumping into yourself, you know, when you sort of start going in circles. But with a book is so massive. The truth is, I don't know what you all think, but you could easily take 10 years or more for any book project. They're so vast that you can always keep going. And sometimes you just have to stop. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any easy answer to that. What do you guys think?
No, I mean, I said to my editor, we have to run this thing before they reopen all 40 miles of the Kalamazoo River that was sullied by this diluted bitumen. That's my mission. So we did. Yeah. So we because there were some close calls. We didn't want too much to happen because we had, you know, this was our niche. We were on the cutting edge of it. We needed to drive it home before everybody was covering it and it was done. There needed to still be some suspense. That was really important to me, so I kind of drove that train pretty hard.
Sometimes it's nice to have the luxury of events, you know, just sort of, listen, I have to get this done because there's an anniversary or something's going to change, and you really need that, as with any journalism project.
For me, it was a matter of saying, have I identified the story? Have I told the story? Have I documented the story? And then to remember what Jim Cobb, one of my advisors, said, widely published, hugely regarded, he said, I've never published a book that I didn't want to change something to it afterwards. And that gave me leave to say, okay, it's done.
Well, my author friends seem to be always in shock about how much marketing they have to do.
We're going
to
get that. Yeah.
So I'm wondering, do agents and publishers check to see whether you've got a website or a Facebook site and you're tweeting?
Yeah, they do ask you that. That you actually, if you go the big publisher route, they have you fill out a questionnaire just before the book is published, and the marketing people get involved, and they ask you who you know, what groups you're a member of, how many Twitter followers you have, how many Facebook friends you have, you know, who you know, what you've done in the past, you know, they want to know all that, but they're not going to do it for you. Certainly your agent doesn't do any marketing for you. And your publisher, if you're lucky, will do some marketing. But maybe that's just the segue we need, because we've only got, you know, less than 10 minutes left here, and I really want to talk about post-publication marketing, because that has become so incredibly important. And people on the panel have done interesting things, you know, in terms of pushing their book out, and so I want to make sure we talk about that. Like, I know, Judy, that's something.
That was the positive side of that advance publisher balance, that this publisher really knows how to sell books. And a key part of that is time frame. In commercial publishing, often, if you don't hit it in the first 6 weeks, it goes in the back burner, and then it goes in the boxes go in the warehouse. It's amazing how quickly that happens. Chelsea Green, the people at Chelsea Green said that sometimes it takes 5 years for a book to catch on, and they keep their books in print. When they purchase your book, they're supported. They're behind that book for the long haul. They have two staff members, and this is in a really small staff that handle author events. So they do the groundwork to get you
In conferences like, you know, for me, the NOFA conferences, Northeast Organic Farmers Association things, and they keep you up to date in colleges, universities. And also they did a really incredible thing for me because I think they knew that this would be a sleeper, you know, like no one's out there, you know, gee, I really wonder what books there are out there on soil. So they hired a radio publicist. You know, that was an investment, but that was really, really important. And
yeah, there's just an endless amount of radio in this country, talk radio in this country, and they're eager to talk.
I probably did about close to 50 radio interviews. I don't know about you guys. Yeah, about that.
Oh no, I was just talking.
I'm sorry.
Radio interviews, like 100, yeah, something like that. A lot. And after a while, I just started saying no. So, Duncan, what have you done, if anything, to sort of push your book out?
My target audience in terms of getting the book out is law professors. The case that this book is about is typically the first one in an environmental law casebook. And professors typically like to assign their casebook, but they want one side reading that will flesh out the thing. So I accept every law school engagement I can get and make friends with the professors. I'm headed off to University of Tennessee Law School a week and a half from now. And those I find thrilling. It's gratifying to see that they are being used, which means they're being sold, and that, frankly, that it's respected among the people I care about.
That's great. For the commercial route, the things that matter most, the marketing is very circular. The marketing is largely determined by the reviews and the press. And, of course, the reviews and the press are, in fact, driven by the marketing, you know. And so somehow you have to begin that process. You know, you have to have the sort of initiating event. And there's no predicting what that might be. In my case, I had really great early trade press reviews, and then that caught the attention of the New York Times, which gave the book a great review. And then when that happened, suddenly Random House, which hadn't expressed a lot of interest in my book, frankly, suddenly I had two assigned publicists, and they were lining things up right and left. And then you sort of ride that wave for a while, and then the wave declines, and then it becomes more on you as the publisher, that if you want to keep doing this, you know, then it's sort of like, well, you more requests start to come directly to you instead of through the publisher. And I don't think that's an unusual pattern. I think that happens a lot, and it's sort of what Judy was saying, that smaller houses maybe tend to have a little more patience, and the larger houses, they want you to start selling pretty quickly, and if you don't, they'll lose interest. They won't stop carrying the book, but they're in touch with Barnes & Noble and Amazon every day. They know exactly what's selling and what isn't, and they arrange their marketing accordingly. They're not going to invest in you. They're less likely to invest in you unless there's some tangible evidence that the thing is selling. So maybe we have time for just like a couple more questions, and then we've got to wrap up.
Dirty word, branding. And this might only apply to Judy, who's got nonfiction and fiction out. Any concerns that you're trying to address to hit those two sides?
No, I changed my website. I had the, you know, I had my website which had like this, you know, Vienna, you know, like. Graphics and stuff, and now my website, which actually I designed myself this round, has this. I'm not worried, you know, writer, whatever, you know, maybe if, I don't know, it doesn't concern me.
Yeah, people go back and forth, you know. Yes.
Is there a website or a resource that says, you know, the proposals or the books that are being worked on that will come out? Then the training people who work at training publications want to write about them.
Yeah. Publishers Weekly is sort of the dominant force pre-publication, and if you're a really savvy author like a Rebecca Skloot type, you pitch Publishers Weekly and they will write stories about your book while it's in progress. You know, if you figure out some new thing that you're doing or whatever, and get the trade press to write about you. But I'm not aware of any publicly accessible database that says, okay, here's what's out, here's what's in progress. People just read Publishers Weekly, and like if you got a decent advance, your agent will tell Publishers Weekly about it. They won't divulge the exact size of your advance, but they'll say low six figures, you know, which probably means $101,000. All right, a couple more, yeah.
For the narrative writing section, I found the Mayborn Literary Nonfiction Conference really helpful. They have a couple of competitions, one for literary nonfiction, one for books. And if you submit, like, you know, if you enter that competition, they take the top 50 and then put you in a workshop prior to the conference with an editor and 10 other people, and they all read your stuff and give you great feedback. So I really highly recommend that.
Yeah, conferences can be really useful, including this one, although you wouldn't know from my own ineptitude and marketing your book. But yeah, and many authors now, we don't have time to talk about this, but many authors now, not only to publicize their book, but they make, you know, significant income by actually going and speaking places, that has become an important part of the author's portfolio. It used to be that you would just go places just to publicize your work, but now it's kind of an income stream. These kind of events can be an income stream if you want that. So Jay is giving me the high sign. I feel like we really need to stop. Our real breakfast is here, or at least some version thereof.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's what we've got. We've got like about 35 types of coffee back there. There's an actual warm breakfast, and it is super fresh, and it looks really good. So brunch. Now, there's a couple other things. There's an exhibit upstairs that will blow you away. So I mean, you've got like a half hour to eat, go see this exhibit. Wait a minute. Pitch Slam. Now before you go, Bill's got a quick announcement here. If you want to sign up for the Pitch Slam, go find Bill and sign up there. EJ, is there anything to say about the drawing anymore?
Just to remind people if they want to be in the draw, get your name in the box.
Okay, yeah, get it in there, then we'll do the drawing at the beginning of the Pitch Slam. All right, go.